Oh, go ahead. That was the beginning. Go ahead.
Fucking you had your momentum.
Yeah, yeah. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going
to
warn you.
I was just about to start, but you had to fucking blurt something out. Go ahead.
I already fucked it up. I just wanted
to. No, we've started. Now this is it. That's how it is.
Okay. I was just trying to warn you that I was going to be using a lot of different nicotine products, and I don't know why I felt compelled to let you know.
How many nicotine products?
Well, I'm going to bounce back and forth between dip, which I'm quitting in 3 days, and then some nicotine gum.
Ah.
Yeah. So because I'm quitting in 3 days, I'm going very hard right now.
I see.
Yeah.
Did you ever smoke cigarettes?
Oh, yeah. For 10, probably longer. 14 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've been off for 14 years.
The other day, I bummed a cigarette from somebody, and I felt like I was out with people, and somebody went out to have a smoke. And I was like, you know what? Literally, I have not smoked a cigarette since 2001.
Okay, 18 years.
Yeah, yeah. And so it wasn't unpleasant. Mm. But it was, it wasn't great.
Yeah.
But it was just enough to realize, like, oh man, I should not do this.
Right.
Like, wow. Cause it was like a sleeping golem inside me woke up and like, give me more of that.
Oh, yeah. You know? That's, people in sobriety will talk about that a lot where it's like, someone will have 12 years of sobriety or maybe in my case, I had 6 the first time I did opiates for like a surgery.
Yeah.
And at that point I was like, you know, I just forget what it's like to be in the tiger ravenous mode. And
yeah,
I think maybe
yeah.
that is a past version of myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then as soon as that shit gets in me, I turn into a scumbag.
Oh really?
Yeah. Cause Kristen holds the medicine.
Yeah.
And she has to dole it out on the prescribed schedule.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find immediately I start becoming so nice to her, so charming. Can I help anything? And then slowly I'll explain to her that, you know, well, I used to have a huge tolerance, so they don't work as well for me.
Boy.
I'm also 200 pounds and 6'2". That's for everyone. That you would get the same prescription. And I just turn into a fucking scumbag. Yeah,
yeah. You start enlisting people that you meet on the street to like steal them from her.
Yes, yes.
Some other woman comes in and Jess. Like, who's this? That's Jasmine.
her foot hurts so bad. She doesn't think she can walk back to see her kids. And they're alone.
Yeah. She's not sure where they are. It might take a while. She might be walking for a while.
Yeah, but were you a heavy smoker?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like we'll continue with this, but I do feel like I should introduce the show.
Okay.
We started a sloppy way here.
Yeah.
But folks, you're listening to 3 questions. But I mean, how would you stumble upon this?
That's right.
How does one stumble upon this and not know that I'm talking to my boyfriend and lover, Dax Shepard?
Yes.
My sweetheart.
I'm sorry, I got kind of infected your show because I like to parachute into conversation.
You did, and I remember when I did your show, and when I've listened to it, it does seem like that. Like you don't do I just like to do it because the music on mine has a nice post.
Oh, okay.
And so it's nice to it hits that post, and then it's like, hey there, and that was I was inhaling and just about to do it right when you started talking about your Copenhagen.
Well, do you do an intro though?
No, not really.
Okay.
Just sort of like, hey, here we are. And it's, you know, it's variable, but,
But that makes sense. Cause I have an intro and I go, today I'm going to talk to Andy Richter. He's the greatest.
Oh
blah,
no,
blah,
I
blah.
Don't, I don't pre-tape. It's like we start right here and then I just start.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In which case you definitely need to say who you're talking
yeah,
to.
Yeah, yeah. It's Dax Shepard, everyone.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
I'm happy to have you. You had me on yours, which was very helpful on the day that mine launched. I had the number one podcast in the country for approximately 14 hours.
That's great.
Oh, my God. I was such a dick.
Were you?
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah.
Loud
it
over.
I was just smashing into cars. I just rented a Maserati and smashed into parked cars.
Put diesel in it.
Yeah, yeah. Back to the nicotine. Yeah, I smoked... I smoked from when I was 17 until when I was 34, 35.
A little longer than me.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Because in 2001 I was, yeah, 34.
When you took a hit of this, were you struck with the absurdity of the activity itself? Because I've been off of it so long that now when I look at it, I go, my goodness, I thought, let's put some smoke in this body.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it really, something sunk in where I was like, drink gasoline. Why stop with fucking filling these tiny little organs with smoke?
You know, that's the thing too, is that like I go back and forth about smoking weed, although I don't really smoke, like I don't smoke herb, as they say, anymore. And I now am currently in a period of abstaining because the problem is, like now if there's a vape pen, like I just had a few weeks ago where I had a few weeks off and it was vacation. I was like, all right, I'm going to go pick up a vape pen. And
sure.
Basically, if anyone watched the Comic-Con shows, I was high the entire time, just if you want to know, you know, if my mom's listening, to let her know that.
And that can work
not
with
really,
both if you...
Not really during the show, I'm kidding. But yeah, but like, I mean, yeah, it's like, all right, sure. You know, because I can maintain as virtually 80% of Los Angeles now, maintain a level of productivity while being a little bit high, you know?
Sure, sure.
It's a just, for me, it's like a toggle switch that's contentment. Like I go from being kind of a slightly crabby asshole that's just fighting with his politeness in order to like not be, let the crabby asshole out, to being like, no, I actually kind of am content being alive and I enjoy what's happening right now, you know? So
yeah.
Well, it for years it was a self-medicating thing.
Well, also though, with the legalization, it's a far more predictable exercise now.
Like, yes.
I think Dan Savage says he misses the days of playing pot brownie roulette.
Yes.
Like where you might get the piece that has 70 grams of THC.
Absolutely.
And then you might get the one with zero.
And also the weed. It's like you would get, people would say, oh, this is really good. And it was just basically, you know, chopped up rope or something.
Right.
And there was no kind of like indica sativa.
Top cider.
Like, what the hell is indica sativa? No, I bought a bag of weed. You know, you didn't have any idea.
Well, and then they make these dose pens, right?
Yes.
That vibrate. My wife has these. They vibrate when you get an exact amount of something.
Right, right. Is she using it for CBD or?
Oh, recreational.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, not a ton. She's very streaky, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
She'll have a month where she does it, and
yeah.
then I'll be like, honey, have you noticed you haven't done it in 2 months? And she doesn't notice. I mean,
right.
She's so not an addict.
Yeah, yeah.
I think when we first started dating, she smoked kind of casually.
Cigarettes. Yeah.
And again, like, maybe a month and a half went by, and I was like, wow, you did a great job quitting smoking, man. You didn't get grumpy or anything. She's like, I didn't quit smoking. I'm like, you haven't had one for 6 weeks? And she's like, I haven't? And I could have fucking choked her to death.
My mom had a friend, or still has a friend. I don't know if she's still smoking, but she for years would buy a pack of cigarettes and keep them in the freezer because she would only like smoke one or two a weekend.
Oh, man.
And at the time, I was a smoker, and I was like, how do you do that? How do you not just like – shove your face into a carton and then shove it into a bonfire.
I kept cartons in my freezer.
I didn't keep cartons in my freezer just because I didn't have that kind of good common sense.
Right, because it was dramatically cheaper.
Ridiculously cheaper.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I'm not even sure. How much do cigarettes cost now?
About $150 a pack.
They must be. I mean, because I don't know. I think they were like $6 when I quit.
And I don't say this in a judgmental way. I say it in an I'm aware of it way, where I have some friends back home that like will be struggling with money and I'll help out. And I do notice they do smoke a couple packs a day.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I'm not judging. I just am aware. Well, it's about $100 a week habit, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It really has gotten so expensive.
Yeah.
I would be looking for, growing it in the backyard.
Yeah.
Like people do weed.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, and like when you say about like intaking smoke into your lungs, I mean, I still, like that to me is like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good delivery system for whatever you want to do, you know.
Sure.
And the vaping too is a lot easier.
Mm.
Like when I was, you know, I keep getting sinus infections, and I actually have had sinus surgery, and it was like, and the missing component of like, I got sinus surgery and it got a lot better, but the missing component of why I'd get like sinus infections that would last months and months and months. Was that I was probably smoking weed in the middle of there. So I, like, you know, I'm like, It's like trying to heal a leg, yet taking a small ball peen hammer and knocking on your knee at night, you know, like yes. just for fun, you know, because it feels good or something.
But the time that it really strikes me, the absurdity is like occasionally something will burn in the kitchen, you know, and the whole house is full of
And like, smells horrible.
I don't want to be in there. I want to like open those windows, get the fans out, and I want to get the fuck out. My instinct is not to go in there and start inhaling a ton
deeply.
Of that. Yes.
Yum.
Yet if it were somehow laced with nicotine, I'd be like, oh, it's great.
All right. I'm going to set up a hammock.
I'm going to baste a honey-baked ham in nicotine and then light it.
I even think that nicotine was more – I responded to it more than the THC for some reason. It was just – and I also found there was an existential component to smoking cigarettes that was the answer to the question, what am I going to do now? And I mean, and the bigger question of that, you can answer, well, I'm going to go have a step outside and have a smoke. And that's what you're doing right now.
It gives
now.
You purpose almost.
Yeah, and then you don't have to think about the big question about like, well, what am I actually doing on the planet? And I remember when you could smoke in bars, a big night of drinking was just a big night of smoking.
Oh, that's
– The drinking was so secondary to just like a
bang
fiend.
And darts.
Oh,
yeah.
Just like a pack and a half.
And you can't even unravel the next day's hangover. Oh. You're like, do I just have poisoning from the cigarettes or is it the booze?
Awful.
Ooh, it's rough. Now, I wonder – for me, I think there's like a threefold reason I started in the first place. You know, one is I wanted to look cool and be antisocial.
Yeah.
One, I wanted to prove my bravery. I knew you could die of this. And then I didn't learn until I read Sedaris's Naked, one of his first books. And there's a story in there, Plague of Ticks, which I had a ton of ticks.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Plagued with ticks. And I never connected the dots until I read that story that those mostly stopped when I started smoking cigarettes.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
so I do think
he used to lick light switches and things like
that. Oh, yeah, and count the steps. He'd have to go back and forth to school four times because he'd lose count. And I used to do the weirdest shit. And then I had never connected those dots. But I do think it's also can satiate like OCD stuff.
Yeah,
it gives you this weird bit of control over the next 5 minutes.
Yeah, doing something with your hands. That's just kind of, and you don't have to think about it and it's occupying it.
Taking control of your emotions in a sense, like regulating how you feel. Like, to have the power to light this thing and then now feel a certain way gives you the illusion of control over your.
And you are getting a little speedy rush which always helps OCD stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like a little speedy rush.
And I read this really crazy. Should there be any overlap listeners of this show and mine? I've talked about it way too many times, but I read this really great New York Times article from a psychiatrist who was interviewing a new patient, and the new patient was going through her life, and she doesn't do drugs, she doesn't drink, blah, blah, blah. But the whole time she was chewing this gum and she put a few pieces in, and towards the end of it, she said, you know, as you probably see, I'm very heavily addicted to nicotine. I don't know if that's good or bad. And the psychiatrist said, well, let me actually research it before I tell you it's good or bad. But what this psychiatrist pointed out was that she could identify people's mental health issues by the drugs they used recreationally. Uh-huh. So case in point is if she has a patient that can do a line of cocaine and then go straight to sleep.
Yeah.
That person has ADHD.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's obvious. And people who use marijuana and feel somehow energized by that and creative and productive, those people generally have depression.
Yeah.
And the point she was making was just, there's drugs on planet Earth. There have been forever. Yep. And people find the ones they need.
Yeah.
We have some as psychiatrists. We have ones we offer, but they're basically doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And people tend to find their shit. Ultimately, her recommendation on the nicotine was it raises your blood pressure, which if you have high blood pressure, that's no good. But it also delays the onset of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So there is some upside to it.
Oh, wow.
So ultimately, her recommendation was not to quit.
Right, right.
Yeah, I just found that to be just an interesting thought that we find our shit.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And we will never not strive to get high. We will never not strive to alter our consciousness. I remember in I think it was high school in health class, there was some old movie about drugs and alcohol. It may have been like a Disney movie from like the late 60s or something. And it was very old. Kind of, you know, that animation style that was supposed to look artsy, but it was really just lazy. Like you didn't, you know, no. But I remember they were sort of, there was like, how did we start drinking alcohol? And there was a caveman And they just, they illustrated this, like, fruit falling off a tree into a puddle, rotting, and then a caveman coming and drinking the puddle. And it really is like, yeah, that's probably how it happened.
Well, elephants hide fruit and let it ferment and then eat it and get drunk.
And moose knowingly. When the apples get rotten, there are moose that attack towns in Sweden because they're on a drunk.
They're on a bender.
They get terrorized by drunken moose. Yeah.
Man, and have you been next to a moose in real life?
Oh my God, they're the most terrifying. Those in Buffalo. Buffalo are ridiculous.
I don't know why they can't photograph them in a manner that lets you know how big they are.
You need to
be next to one. Yeah, they're like 1,800 pounds.
Like an RV.
Yeah. They're fucking, the rack is like 8 feet in the air.
It's crazy.
I was in, this is one of the crazier things I witnessed. I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, at a friend's house. Older friend of mine, he's coming up on 70, and we're in his backyard, and he and I are just talking in the backyard, and it's nighttime, and then between him and this little lake behind him is maybe 9 feet. He's standing about 9 feet from this lake, and just out of nowhere, a fucking moose at full sprint runs between him and the lake, and I was like, and he spun around, and I was like, you almost got hit by a car. Like, watched you almost get killed.
Yeah.
Just sitting in the backyard.
Yep. Mm. And did he say that happens frequently, or was he
sees them. He's never been grazed by one at a full canter.
Wow. Yeah. Well, now you're from Michigan.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yes. Now, proudly. Are you from the suburbs or from,
yes, I am from, and then I think you and I talked, we shared this a little bit in common. I'm from the last town that would be a suburb, but then transitions into farmland.
Yes, that's so exactly how I grew up.
It was about probably 30 miles as the crow flies from downtown Detroit.
Has it become more suburban since your childhood? Because that's certainly the case with Yorkville, which is the town I grew up in.
Yeah, it had this kind of spike in like McMansion construction. Mm-hmm. When I grew up there, it was very blue collar, and I would say a good half of the town was probably below the poverty line.
Yeah.
And then after I left, I would say it became kind of upper middle class. Yeah. And then I think that plateaued and now maybe is, I don't know. I don't know what's happening.
But the point was there were
people there that like had money. And then there were kids getting on the bus that had shit on their boots from having mucked a stall.
Precisely. Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, because when I was there, the people that were wealthy, they were like, I'm thinking of like the richest
in Michigan?
People. No, in Illinois.
Oh, okay.
In Illinois, the town I grew up in, Illinois. The wealthy people, there were some people who came out there to be like horse people.
Oh, uh-huh.
So they were rich, but they still would have horse shit on them.
Yeah.
And then, but then
like
there was
Mandeville
like.
Canyon.
Yeah. But then I love to remember there was another family, I think that like owned nursing homes or something. And they were, but they just had a big car. They weren't like,
right.
You know, they didn't like wear designer clothes or anything.
Right.
We had a McDonald's open and it was like a huge deal. Like literally the morning the McDonald's opened, like half of the town came in.
Like a Whole Foods coming somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was McDonald's.
Right, it was the antithesis of Whole Foods.
And then that was when I was a kid. And then in high school, there were many nights where what you did was hang out in McDonald's parking
lot. Oh, fuck yes.
There was so little to do in your life that you just go to McDonald's and just sit there all fucking night.
Yeah, ours was the Milford Cinema, which had a screen that is half the size of my current living room TV. And
now that either means you're Mr. Big Shot or it was a shitty theater.
You know, I think every American practically, even if you're broke, has an obnoxiously big TV. Yeah. When I go through Costco, I'm like, that's what they cost now? Yeah, $600 for a 65. Remember when we were kids, if someone had that Zenith console TV,
mm-hmm.
80% of it was wood.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then there was maybe like a 27-inch screen inside. Yep. And those fucking things were $1,300, $1,400.
Yeah, yeah.
You were rich if you had one.
Yeah.
Now it's like you see people getting evicted and on the curb with the trash bag luggage is a 65-inch TV.
Yeah, is a disposable flat screen.
Yeah, like people don't even steal TVs anymore. When we were kids, mm-mm. when our house got robbed, they stole the TVs.
And I don't think I've had a TV repaired in 15, 20 years.
No,
you just throw them out.
You throw them right.
Because they'll be like, well, yeah, I could fix it, but it'll cost $4 less than a new one.
Yeah, just leave the hatchback open, put it in there, drive around for a while. Eventually, the problem will be solved.
Or in the alley. Everything goes from the alley. You put something in the alley, it goes.
But the interesting thing about where I lived is then Kristen lived, again, 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
But she is very metropolitan, and I very much am a hillbilly.
Yeah.
You know, like the shit we did was straight redneck.
Was she a fancier town or a more sophisticated?
Yeah, she was, 8 Mile, obviously, is the famous division between Detroit and most of the suburbs.
Yeah.
And she lived at 9 Mile.
Oh, so, I see.
But in a nice, kind of just a hip, cool downtown city-ish type environment. All like of her neighbors.
GM executives kind of living there. Well,
specifically,
sort of thing,
she grew up in a area called Huntington Woods. I couldn't even think of the real name because everyone, including its residents, call it Hanukkah Woods. She was the only Gentile in that whole neighborhood.
Oh, I see.
And then bleeding into Birmingham, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And so just a completely different, like when we share our childhood stories, we could be from two different states.
Yeah, yeah.
It's dramatically different.
Yeah.
The absolutely. Amount of fighting that happened at my school and stuff, she's just like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I saw a fight twice in my life. And I'm like, first there was one every day of the week, and then ones were scheduled for the Milford Cinema, and on Friday night you saw three or four fights.
Yeah, yeah.
And what
and
on
would
else
they get
was,
nasty and violent?
Oh, yeah, the bloody, broken noses, the whole nine yards. And then I think way more sexual activity because we were bored too. Like, several girls were pregnant in my eighth grade class. Yeah. People were just, they were finger blasting and they were punching dudes. And that's just.
I hope not one right after the other.
Well, there was some
hand washing in between. I mean, or maybe I don't know. Let everyone have what they want.
There's clearly one direction it can go, which is fine.
Right.
Which is the finger blasting happens before the right hook.
Yeah, yeah.
It should not be reversed. No one should have blood on their hand.
You know what? I'll get back to you.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Ask some people.
I mean, the weekend's right around the corner. I'll let you know.
And I always just really quick, I just think of now the poor adults that would go to that movie. I can't imagine they ever went more than once.
That movie theater,
because it was at 90% occupancy. It was taken by 12 and 14-year-olds. 7th through 8th grade, 6th through 8th grade was the and people were just jumping over seats and screaming and throwing. So, I mean, God bless those out of towners.
Ours was a little calmer, I think. I mean, there was a division in my town between. What was known, and it was just because it was so small. I mean, I think our school had like maybe 600 kids, maybe 600 or 700 kids total.
Our high school. Oh, okay.
So it was, it was a fairly smallish class. So there wasn't like a lot of room for differentiation in terms of your groups. Like there wasn't like science geeks. And I mean, there was a couple kids like that, or there wasn't theater kids. There was just jocks and burnouts.
Well, what's interesting is it's kind of, it mirrors the dynamic of small towns versus big towns, which is my high school is big enough that you could be anonymous in some ways, right?
Like it was hard in our school.
Right. Like you could be a dick to some guy or he could be a dick to you. And then you might not see that guy for a week or whatever it was. So I think it's kind of like it was a microcosm of what now has happened on the internet, where it's just like, you kind of feel anonymous about it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Although now, there is the difference that there is, like, you do get, regardless of where you are, like, if you grew up in my town and you were, like, just a full-on theater kid,
mm-hmm.
You didn't have anywhere, you had to be a theater kid kind of on your own, but also sort of have friends that, played basketball or friends that were farm kids or friends that, you didn't get to, like, just... But now you really get to
isolate in your tribe.
Yeah, you really get to kind of find your tribe at an early age, at least in a virtual kind of way. Well,
was there a predominant group that settled the area you lived in? Because this was all kind of a mystery to me until I read a Malcolm Gladwell book that talked about the culture of pride mm-hmm. in Northern Kentucky and Appalachia. Uh-huh. Have you read that book by chance? Well, it talks about that, these historic feuds like the Hatfields and McCoys mm-hmm. and all this, there's a huge history. That's just one that we know.
Yeah.
There's thousands of family feuds that have ended in multiple murders in that area, right? And then he even goes through like – how the court trials, basically, they just can't convict anyone. Because if you're like, well, he called my wife a bitch.
Yeah.
And they're like, acquitted, you know?
Right, of course.
So he really dives into
why. He took my hog.
Right. And the his reason is, and maybe it's not his and he borrowed it, but most of the people that ended up in Northern Kentucky came from Scotland, Ireland, different herding backgrounds. So farming communities are subsistence modes. You have clear boundaries of your farmland. You work it.
And there's a finite set of resources in terms of grazing land between you and the next town
and
over.
It's permeable and no one has rights to it. So these guys are herding sheep on the Scottish hillsides. Well, no one owns that, right? So you're staking out an area that you're herding in and you got to fucking stand up for that area.
Right.
So, and you just look at the cultures that had a lot of herding without defined borders, the Bedouins, all these different people. And there's an increased level of you got to stand your ground, you got to fight. And it's prized and it's honored and it's respected. Anywho, so this whole pride of culture thing, Michigan got a huge influx of Kentucky folks, Tennessee folks when the auto boom happened.
Sure.
My grandparents are both from Kentucky.
Yeah.
Most of the people in my town, or many of them, had grandparents that were from that culture of pride area.
Yeah.
So I do think it was uniquely like stand your ground, you know, punch a guy who says your sister's hair looks bad. I don't know. I that's my explanation
for it. The displacement of Appalachian people, because in Chicago, on the north side of Chicago, there's I don't know how much it is anymore, but even when I was a young man, deeply hillbilly areas.
Right.
Because people, when they would cut the top off a hill to strip mine it in Kentucky or West Virginia, they'd say, go to Chicago and we'll set you up and we'll get you a job in a factory. Except there was no, they would give them cheap housing, but there would be no factory and there'd be no job.
Right.
So there are all these and I mean, you go into like shitty little taverns, which is where we would all go.
Yeah.
And there was nothing but like, you know, there was nothing but like,
it felt like it had been cast.
Yeah. Like it was like, you know, it was all like, you know, the jukebox was all country music. It was all, you know, like Slim Whitman and, you know, and the people would be, and I'd, you know, and I'd go in and I like old country music and I'd play old country on the jukebox. And I remember this one night, a guy turned around. He's like, who played this Marty Robbins? And I was like, I did. I don't remember what song. He goes like, my dad plays Marty Robbins. What the hell are you playing? Like, he was angry.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I like Marty Robbins. And he immediately was like, oh, I do too. Like, just switched around. But it was funny that.
I wonder if it was that it reminded him of dad and he didn't want to be reminded dad at the right time.
He seemed to be very drunk. Okay. And it seemed to be a normal state of
the
being.
The logic wasn't linear.
Yeah.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
So what was your household like? I mean, I know you were raised mostly by a single mother.
That's right. My mother left my father when I was 3. My brother was 8. My sister wasn't here yet. And she had not worked up to that point. So she got a job working at General Motors as a janitor on the night shift.
Uh-huh.
And we moved into this tiny little apartment that everyone was on welfare, ironically overlooking the Milford Cinema later to come into play.
Yeah.
And we were there for probably, what's funny now that I'm older and time's moving so much quicker, I think like, oh, we lived in those for so, now I recognize like we were there for a year.
Yeah.
And then we moved to like.
And was your dad, he didn't provide support?
My father kept the family house.
Oh, wow.
Got his buddy who he sold cars with to move into my bedroom.
Oh, wow.
Greg, who amazingly my mother ended up marrying. That was my first stepdad, was the guy who took over my bedroom.
Wow, wow, wow.
But my mom, to her credit, she started as a janitor. Then she started working in the tool crib. Then she became a manager of the tool crib. So we were always on that climb. And I would say we were in a little townhouse till I was probably 6. And then we moved to our first house that my mom bought for us in a pretty nice little lower middle class neighborhood in Highland. And then Greg, my dad's buddy, she then married, got pregnant with my sister, and my sister arrived, and then Greg was out of there before Carly was maybe 6 months old. And then we lived on our own for maybe a few years. Then a new stepdad who was an engineer at GM. We were with him. He had 2 kids. We moved into his house.
There were 5 kids, 3 and 2? Yeah.
Yeah.
And how was that? Contentious, okay.
Well, there's a bunch. There's a funny version, and then there's the shitty version, and I'm happy to tell both. But one of the just really.
Why don't you make them one? Okay, I mean, it's such a time saver.
Yeah, Jesus okay. Maybe you'll be wiping a tear away and then laughing.
I try to keep this thing to an hour, man.
Okay, so the order of his children were he had a son that was exactly my brother's age, and then he had a daughter who was exactly between my brother and I.
Okay.
So I knew her from elementary school.
Uh-huh.
Heather. And I had a huge crush on her.
Oh, wow.
Before I knew my mom was.
At what age?
Dating this guy. Second grade.
Oh, wow.
Third grade.
Okay.
Yeah, so my brother was probably in eighth grade. I was probably in second grade. She was probably in fourth or fifth grade. So she was in love with my brother. I was in love with her. And that was the triangle that existed for, I don't know, maybe the first 6 months we all lived together.
Wow.
And I used to have these fantasies.
And how did your brother feel about her?
Oh, he
indifferent?
Yeah, completely. Yeah, he did not want her to look at him. Uh-huh. You know, when you're older and some younger person likes you and you have morals, you're like, I don't even want to.
Yeah.
I don't want to happen to notice you might be good looking.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, back to that.
That was really funny. That's just the kind of comedy headline of it. But the stepdad, he would go to Arizona in the winter because they had to continue to test the cars they were engineering, mm-hmm. and there was snow in Michigan. So he would go. So my poor mother stepped in the situation where she now had five kids and a full-time job. And it just wasn't ideal.
And a husband that was
in and out.
Yeah.
And a much different culture, house culture than we had curated in our home.
Uh-huh.
And so that too didn't work out. And then I guess in sixth grade, they got divorced. And then I temporarily, with my brother, moved in with my dad. And it was right before my dad got sober. That was a pretty gnarly.
Why did you move in with your dad? I mean,
because my mom left my stepdad.
Yeah.
We didn't have a place to live. She had sold our house. And then she decided she was going to build a house herself.
Oh, I see.
And then that process took obviously a year.
Yeah.
There's really nowhere for us to go. My mom and sister went to her friend's house she worked with and they stayed there. And then my brother and I went to my dad's house. And that lasted about 6 months.
And was your dad like a stable presence?
No, he was I'm going to preface by saying, because I've gotten to a bad habit of only airing my grievances with him.
I understand.
Evolved.
I've been caught in the same thing.
Yeah. Very evolved man.
Mm-hmm.
Many of his friends were gay. All of his girlfriends were Jewish or black. He was a kind of an evolved dude. Very huggy, affectionate, said, I love you.
Yeah.
He also had a bad drinking and coke problem.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a ton of time for us. So we saw him every other weekend. But in general, at least half of those, he just drove us straight to my grandparents' house, which was great because that was my favorite place on earth.
Yeah.
So when I moved in with him, that was virtually the first time I'd lived with him that I could remember.
Uh-huh.
I had been with him until three, but I didn't really remember. And I was riding bikes in the neighborhood one day, and I came home, and there was like six kids from the neighborhood all at the end of my driveway on their bikes, and they looked quite concerned, and they said, we don't know what's going on in there. There's a fight, and so I walk in the house. My dad's sitting shirtless on the couch. The coffee table is shattered. There's glass everywhere. He's smoking a cigarette out of breath. He has a bloody nose. I go, oh my God, what happened? Right then I hear my brother from upstairs going, pack your shit, we're fucking leaving. And I look up the stairs. His shirt's ripped in half. He's bleeding. They've just had a full battle royale in the house.
How old is your brother at this time?
If I was in sixth grade, he was 17.
Oh, wow.
And my dad's was a big fucking guy.
Yeah.
And my brother did not lose the fight.
Wow.
they were both very tore up. And so once I saw my brother, because through all these iterations, you know, my mom, who's my favorite human being on earth, I can also be critical of and say she's a human and she needed affection and love. We'd be the core. She'd meet a guy. That guy would be the core for a while. And so my brother and I were the thing. We were each other's safety net. All of our security was each other. So when I saw my brother bleeding and his shirt torn, I went downstairs and I'm like, you're a fucking piece of shit. I hate you. Fuck you.
To your dad?
Yeah.
You're
the worst fucking dad. You know, really let him have it. We moved out of the house that afternoon. went and lived in this woman's small two-bedroom house while the house got finished. And then we all moved as a family to a house, which was quite nice. And it was in Milford, where I was saying that the farmland meets the suburbs.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that was just the three of you, the three siblings and your mom.
That's right. Yeah, okay. Four of us. And that, I would say, was kind of, for me, I don't know if you have this. You didn't move much, right? You kind of stayed?
Yeah, pretty much. And at least, yeah.
But I don't know why, but chronologically we were at places longer. But for me, my childhood is really the 3 years in Milford in that house with my mom, no husband. That was like, I meet my best friend. My whole life kind of started.
Sixth grade to high school.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, unlike most people, loved junior high. If I could live a year of my life over and over again and be seventh grade.
Wow.
It's just the most fantastic year.
Yeah.
And then weirdly, my dad got sober when I was in seventh grade. He then got in a crazy car accident going into ninth grade. He literally needed someone to live with him to just function.
Wow.
I used to tell that story as just, I went to help my dad. Additionally, I was so terrified of going to high school because I had made a lot of enemies with a lot of tough jock type guys. And I was pretty certain.
In junior high?
Yes. So half the reason junior high was so good was that when I went to sixth grade, my brother gave me a side spike and he dressed me in Vans and Levi's.
What does a side spike mean?
So I had like a spiky hairdo on the side big bangs that swooped down.
Yeah,
I did not pick this hairdo.
Kind of like a Cameron Esposito haircut?
I don't
know. Do you know who that is?
No, I don't.
But you would if you...
mid-80s skater cut.
Okay.
But very fashion forward for junior high.
Yeah.
My brother was 5 years older. So he dressed me in 501s in Converse and I skateboarded all because of him. And when I got into junior high, the eighth grade girls liked me a lot when I was in sixth grade.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was tall and I had this cool style.
And you're cute.
Well,
I had a
3 year period where I was really cute.
Listen, you've been cute forever. You know.
But I was so girl crazy and I dated all these popular girls in grades two above me. And those guys did not fucking like that. And I was obnoxious and made a lot of jokes. And I was, you know, all the many reasons you could hate me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was also just very afraid to go to Milford High School.
But you aren't afraid of a fight.
I'm not.
And were you then afraid of a fight? Did that happen?
I had the appropriate amount of fear fighting a guy 2 years older than
me.
I see. And I had seen a lot of fights that got real, real gnarly.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Not like kids wrestling.
Like
on
broken nose.
Yes, broken noses. Yeah. Dudes with casts from punching a guy.
Yeah. Fighting to me was always like, it was not part of the vocabulary. I was always struck, like when I, friends of mine that I ended up knowing in Chicago who grew up on the South Side, where there would be an altercation, and of all the different things that you could choose on how it could go, to me, punch that motherfucker in the face was not like on the table. Like that was just
right.
It was crazy. It's you know, it was as much as like take off your clothes and run around clucking like a chicken.
Yes, but I know you can follow the very simple logic, which is A, I'm envious of that. I don't.
Yeah.
I think it's. I'm not into. I hope my kids never experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm not.
But it's, if it becomes a learned mode of communication.
Well, here's what happens. You, or in my case, me, you know, dude, Dave Buick, this eighth grader was humongous who hated I was dating Sasha, comes up and fucking blasts you in the face. It's very stunning. It takes, you're confused for about 15 seconds after that first hit. And in that 15 seconds, he can do whatever he wants. And you quickly learn, oh, whoever gets hit in the face first generally is losing that fight.
Yeah.
So here's the calculus. Here's the equation.
Yeah.
And now when I think it's going to go that way, I just have a very logical choice to make. Am I going to be the one that swings first or am I going to be trying to gather my shit for 15 seconds?
Yeah,
it's like
the
Mike Tyson has that great quote he just said recently that everyone has a game plan until they're punched in the face.
Yeah, yeah. I think also, too, I benefited from being a large person.
Mm-hmm.
I was always big. I'm from big, you know, like fucking
sturdy
plow
folk.
Horse people. And I think
beasts
it's a
burden. People.
I think the only kind of like bullying that I ever was always threatened by kids that were like older kids but with whom I was about the same size.
I had that too.
And they would just assert themselves. And I remember too, like for years too, and I think I was just so conflict averse from home and just generally that I would shut down, you know, I remember there was some in gym, we played like scooter on little, you know, on these like little furniture dollies. Did you play
Those? Yeah, uh-huh.
Little, it's like a little square piece of hardwood with four wheels on it that you might put a potted plant on and move it around.
Sure.
Except everybody'd be on those and you're playing kind of a soccer game in the gym. And there was one kid that like, there was a kid, and I mean, I'd known him since kindergarten, but he was like one of the quote unquote burnout kids. And he like knocked me off my cart or something, just too aggressive. And I like flared and just like went up behind him and gave him a full on blast kick in the middle of the back and sent him on his face on the floor. Uh-huh. And he got up like in a crazy wild rage, screaming at me, spittle flying. And I was just like, I was totally stunned by that. And in retrospect, it's probably because this kid lived a horribly violent existence.
Sure.
And I didn't.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I had witnessed unpleasantries, but it was not the same. But yeah, no, I still, it's like.
Well, I'm leaving out probably half of it, which I can unfortunately own now, which is I had a brother that was 5 years older than me. He so had the upper hand.
Yeah.
He fought me all day long, every day. Yeah. I was his Nintendo before there was a Nintendo. So I had that. And then I also had a violent stepdad in the mix. And so when I went to elementary school and I started wrestling with kids my age on the playground, I felt this amazing sense of power and control that I did not have. So I can admit that I was probably first through fourth grade, probably a bully in retrospect. Not picking on the weak people, but I just wanted to be wrestling all the time with whoever I could get it going with. And then, and my best friend was this kid, Clay Smades, who was the co-tough kid in my class.
Yeah.
And I had an epiphany in fourth grade where I was like, you know, Clay, these kids don't like us. They're afraid of us. That's why people are nice to us. They're afraid that we're going to end up fighting them.
Yeah.
And I don't like it. And I actually declared in fourth grade, I'm like, I'm done fighting. And he thought that was ridiculous. And this is really the turning point. I got to sixth grade. I'm done fighting. I'm done fighting for a year and a half. Get to sixth grade to junior high. And there was a kid, a grade older than me, Sean Castle, who wanted to fight me. Didn't want to fight him. He took my bus route home. He followed me off the bus. He threatened me a bunch of times in front of the bus. I somehow talked my way out of that. Then an hour later, I'm at my friend's house watching TV in his living room. Sean Castle walks in. I'm sitting on the couch. He gets on top of me and punches me in the face. I mean, I got to say 15, 20 times. And I just sat there and let him punch me in the face. And about six kids watched. And then he just got bored of it or something, got up and left. In my shame over having not fought back. Was the most brutal, crippling. Would think about it every night as I would go to sleep.
Just
humiliated with myself.
Oh man, I could. I mean, I've gotten a lot better, but you know, a traffic altercation with a "fuck you, no fuck you" that will burn like a cigarette ash for an hour.
Yes.
I mean, like I say, I've gotten better. I can sort of whatever, and I've also sort of again. I have a game plan now. When people get mad at me in traffic, I smile. Like ridiculously huge and give them a big thumbs up, you know, it's just, it always blows their wiring. They're like, "Hey, fuck you, motherfucker. I'm ready to get out of this car." And if you smile and give them a big thumbs up and say, you know, "Okay, buddy.
Yeah.
Way to go."
I'm there now, but it was a long road there. But anyway,
telling me a story about some big musclehead in the parking lot.
Oh, of Albertsons.
Of Albertsons.
Yeah, that was a weird.
A giant guy, and because it had just kind of happened, and the giant guy got out like a huge musclehead, and you were ready to go, and he laughed at you because.
Well, what happened was I was in line at the Albertsons, right? And I was one customer behind this couple, and the guy was a for real bodybuilder. He was like my height and probably 230, and he's wearing like a string tank top and everything. And
then
he just turns to me and he goes, "What movie?" And I go, "What?" And he goes, "What movie do I know you from?" And I go, "Oh, I don't know." And he's like, and then turned his head. I thought that was it, right? I'm also having a terrible day for whatever reason. Yeah. I was having a fucking terrible day. I was single, whatever. And he checks out. I get my shit. I walk out into the parking lot. I have my truck there. And I'm right up to my truck. And he's about 20 cars away by the coffee bean. And he yells, "He was fucking without a paddle in the movie. Fucking sucked anyways, asshole." And I just had this moment where I was like, this guy's going to win, but he's going to get tagged. And yeah, it's fucking worth it. Like, I'll take whatever beating to give him because I'm just, I throw the bag of shit I got in the bed of the pickup truck, and I just start walking very quickly towards him. And I'm going, what motherfucker? You want to fucking do? And I'm unhinged. As I approach him, I start realizing he's getting a little nervous.
Yeah.
And then he has like a tell, basically, where he goes, what the fuck are you doing? I'm so much bigger than you. And I was like, oh my God, I know exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
He has been afraid of this. That's why he got so enormous. Yeah, yeah, he can't fight. He's going to be defenseless.
Yeah.
And I'm screaming. And then he gets in his car and shuts the door in the passenger seat. And his girlfriend gets in the driver's seat. And they lock the doors. And I scream a little bit. And then I'm like, then I walk into Coffee Bean and I'm like, now I'm on full tilt and I gotta calm down before
some
I get
caffeine, please.
He gets back out of the car, he's yelling at. I run out the thing and he jumps back in his car and locks the door, and then they drive away, and that was the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh dear.
So stupid. Yeah, don't recommend it. Not proud of it.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I
met a lovely woman who broadened my view of the world.
I one time and I went to the whole story is, but I'm not a fight, obviously I'm not a fight, but I had, and this sounds so goddamn entitled, but at home, we were going to the Emmys.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And
very
and
relatable
like,
already.
Yeah. Yeah. And number one, I'm like getting on a tuxedo that's too tight.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, you know, having to worry about the kids getting. And when then we get into like my Mazda minivan to drive ourselves to the Emmys because like we're not going to any fucking parties.
Right.
And I, you know, so it's like and I just hate the whole thing. And there was other things going on in my life, but I just.
Well, because, can I pause you for 1 second?
Yeah.
Are you doing what I do before I go to the Emmys or the Golden Globes or the Oscars where I go, I'm going to this thing. I have no business there. Everyone's going to go, why is that guy here? He's
a little bit.
Okay.
Because I'm always amazed by the fact that the rejection junkies that we all are in show business decided to have a way to feel rejected even in our success.
Right,
so
in our community.
Every single category, there's however many people and all but one gets to feel like shit.
Yeah, 80% are losers.
You're being given an award, you know, you're being given the gift of being chosen in this small group when you're already in a fucking small group. This for a living. Your success will be on your wildest dreams.
Yes, more than anyone's entitled.
So we're going to pick the best of those people, and then you're going to go and you're going to sit there dressed up uncomfortably, and you're going and they're going to say, it's not you.
Yes.
And that, you know, and instead it's like, and for us too, it was always like, and it was always the Daily Show.
In the meantime, though, you're going to be up comparing the whole time.
Absolutely.
So you're going to see all these people who are higher on the ladder than you, make more money or
and
more
I'm gonna
popular.
And I'm going to see people I came up with who are now on network sitcoms and making, you know, more money. And so I'm going to be in a lunchroom and there are the cool kids table and I am not fucking there.
Yes.
I know I'm not there.
Yes.
And on our drive down, it was downtown at the, you know, LA Live or whatever, you know, the Staples Center thing.
Yeah.
And a guy bumps us at an intersection and at another light, I'll keep it short. I got out of the car, which I never fucking do. And as I'm getting out of the car, Sarah says, don't. I was all, she just went, don't. And I got out of the car and I walk and I, you know, I'm in a fucking tuxedo.
Right.
And I'm on Olympic Boulevard and like, I think Arlington, some guy that looks like he's a waiter. Cause he's like kind of dressed up. He's in a shitty convertible. And I'm like, what the fuck is your problem? You know,
yeah. Going to
like,
the whole
and
thing.
And he's like, let's pull up. Let's just pull up and talk about it. And I'm like, I'm not going to waste any more fucking time with you. What's your, you know? Yeah. And then as I walk away, he calls me fatso or something. And I just turned back and talked to him. And I was like, you're really fucking brave when my back is to you. And he goes, and he's like, let's just pull over and talk about it. Let's pull over and talk about it.
It's so funny. Yeah, each man's trying to walk away with their pride.
I know. But I just was like, and then it just like, it ruined. I was so dumb. Like misplaced shit.
And to your point, you know, one of the greatest gifts my dad gave me is as he was dying from cancer and I was spending a ton of time with him back in Michigan, my father was never bested. He fought at Costco. He'd get in a shoving match with the free samples. He fought at the gas station. He was always, he was the epitome of like an alpha, unhinged alpha energy, right? And so I was looking at him laying in the bed, and he looked very cute and, you know, now childlike because he was a little scared and all this stuff. And I was kind of able to see him in a different manner, which was really helpful. Yeah. But I was looking at him, and I was like, this is going to be you. This is you. That adrenal dump, the cortisol dump, all the fucking going up to an 11, getting out of the car, all that stuff. I live with that chemistry for another 2 hours after that event. Yeah, and that chemistry kills you.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's part of this recipe. Sure, smoking cigarettes was.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely
is
that.
Is this what you want?
Yes. And I'm like, I'm going to, by winning every interaction, I am going to ultimately lose.
I have a similar thing with my dad, because my dad wasn't physical, but it was my dad's a brilliantly smart man, and like a dog with a bone when he senses he's been wronged. Numerous times in my life, I have seen him make clerks cry over a perceived lack of correct service.
Sure. You know, some indiscretion.
Yeah. And I mean, and he's always ready to go, but in that sense, you know, and I have that too. Like I had to learn early on in my relationships, because it wasn't a physical thing, but I definitely
would intellectually try to tear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone.
And I have, I have a certain grasp of logic that can be definitely used as a cudgel, as a bludgeon.
Yep.
And I have learned over time, there's no winning here. Yeah. There's just assertion of some kind of, it's, you know, a louder voice, basically.
Well, and if you've been given the gift of arguing with someone just like you, because I had a breakthrough about 7 years ago, I started arguing with another actor.
Yeah.
And it went on for an hour and a half. It started in an airport lounge.
Tim Allen?
No.
Jason Priestley.
It started in a first class lounge and then through the entire walk to the gate and then on the plane.
Was
the first
it friendly
class.
Or just?
It was a debate about healthcare.
Oh, I see.
Should have never been having the debate. Yeah. Whatever. I'm sure you know where I stand on healthcare.
Yes, of course.
And then we were separated by about 7 seats in first class, and he continued to shout over, oh, well, maybe everyone should have a cell phone. That should be a right everyone has. Why not give, you know? And I all of a sudden.
I could guess this person in like 3 or 4 guesses.
I'm sure you could.
I bet I could.
And I got to the point where I started pretending that I had fallen asleep. I reclined my seat, and I actually started pretending to fall asleep. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh, all these arguments that you think you've won, people just got bored and exhausted. You haven't won any of them. You didn't convince anyone of a new opinion. You just wore them out.
Yeah.
And that was, I really learned a lot from
you. You have a wonderful amount of self-awareness. You know, like that's like, talk about evolved. That's pretty fucking evolved to learn that much.
Well, I'm trying.
Those different things. Yeah, no, I mean, that's great. That's great. And there's a lot of people, especially that reach a certain level of success in this business. And also, like, you've directed fucking feature films. There's not a lot of directors that are out there learning from their mistakes or thinking about how their actions are impacting others because they've been surrounded by a structure that tells them they're right.
Yeah.
So kudos to you, baby.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. Having to get sober starts you on that path.
Yeah.
Because you quickly learn, like, okay, I'm not using all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I have all the same character defects I was treating with that stuff.
Yeah.
And those are the things that are leading to all my angst and my discomfort. And I got to just start kind of cleaning those up because it's too uncomfortable to not have some medication. So if the medication's gone, it's basically like deciding you're going to change your health with diet or something. It's like I got to prevent the problem from happening before it does. I really want to go back to just one thing about the Emmy thing, which is really funny. So last year, Kristen got nominated for a Golden Globe, which, how exciting. It's so
absolutely
great, you know.
And that's a fun party, supposedly.
Yeah.
I've never been, but.
So you take this moment where she gets nominated. Everyone calls. It's exciting. Mind you, I also add, she doesn't give a fuck, which is one of the things I love about her.
Yeah.
She could care less if she was nominated, and she doesn't care if she wins. In fact, she doesn't want to make a speech, so she'd rather not. With all that said, this special month-long thing where you've been nominated, we get dressed up, we go, And we're seated in the TV section, which is basically on a platform behind all the movie people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But not only does that happen, Jim Carrey then does a bit where he's not allowed to sit with the movie people, that he's got to get kicked into the TV section. And they, for whatever reason, have arranged that he's got to come sit at our table. So, I mean, the actual joke is, oh my God, he's been relegated to the riffraff. And then he sits at our table. And I was just kind of like, well, look how quickly this turned. This went from, oh my God, yeah, so special.
Who's the asshole?
What an honor.
Now?
And then now we're kind of helping relay this like diminished status.
Absolutely.
And I was just like, oh, you can't win.
No.
This is amazing.
No, you have to really, like just not let any of it matter.
Yeah.
Because if you let it matter, I mean, sure, it's nice and it's nice to get a trophy.
Sure.
And that'll never not be nice.
Yeah.
But you can't let it. Like, if you say that winning this trophy is so important that it means losing the trophy is like hugely important too.
Yes.
And then what the fuck are you saying?
Yeah, you got to take the whole thing on.
Absolutely.
And look, I tried to check myself and just go like, let's make sure this opinion isn't informed by the fact that you know you're never winning a statue. like it's very clear to me I will not ever be making a speech at any of those award shows.
Yeah.
So am I now building a case against the entire industry of award shows because I know I'm not getting one? But I do feel like I'm on kind of firm bedrock by saying it's just 100% your ego.
Yeah.
Like it's the result of something. And I've learned in life that the process is the thing to focus on and care about and not the result.
Right.
So it's just kind of antithetical to what I've learned makes me feel happy for a sustained period of time. So yeah, it's well, I didn't, this will sound like, again, I don't think I would have even won one, but I didn't submit. When you're on a TV show, you have to submit to win an Emmy.
Right.
And then the network very much wants you to submit because potentially you could get nominated and that's good for the show and everything. And they were like, hey, submission's coming up. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing it. And they're like, well, you know, you should do it. It's good for the show. And I'm like, A, I'm not getting one. B, I don't even want to be involved in the whole pageant.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm skipping it.
When I was the star of shows, I never did it for myself, but I'd be like, if you want to submit me, go right ahead. I mean, you know.
Right.
And then I would sort of, if they did, then I would follow it and see like, oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I'm glad they really gave me that chance to feel bad about myself.
I mean, which is, you know, some way you just have to acknowledge it is like entering a pageant. Like you have to sign up for the pageant. I just thought, you know, it's, more and more, I don't want to sign up. For
it's that. It's a example of an industry that makes a ton of money throwing big parties to make money. It's just money making parties and
with
advertising.
With the hopes that the show or movie will also then make more money.
Yeah, and there's no advance. It's not about advancing excellence. Like,
no.
It just, you can think that it's that, but it's not really, you know. So.
Yeah.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
So, how do you go from there to showbiz? Like, do you go to, you went to community college?
I bought
a
candy bar. And I opened it up and it had a gold ticket inside.
That's not true.
I moved to California at 20 to Santa Barbara. I'm not sure why. I knew I was moving out here to pursue comedy.
Really?
But I had gone to Santa Barbara on a road trip.
Why comedy? Why did you think like, I'm going to go make money in comedy? Because,
you know,
like I had Chicago to go take improv classes, but I was already there.
Yes. I thought I would do stand up.
Yeah.
And I was just too afraid to do it in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I thought if I move all the way to California, I'll have to. I thought I was painting myself into a box. But then I found out, oh, there's a way for cowards, which is improv and sketch, where you're up there with many people to share the bomb or the success. And so I had a friend that I met that had done Groundlings, and he suggested I go do that. And so right when I got to L.A., I lived in Santa Barbara for 1 year, went to community college there, and then moved to L.A. and got involved with the Groundlings, immediately loved it, and then probably shifted almost immediately to like, oh, well, then I guess I love this thing. So now Saturday Live is where I'm aiming to get.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got there, maybe Maya had just left the Sunday company, Maya Rudolph, and she was on. Then, of course, Will Ferrell had just come out of there and a lot of different growlings. So I thought, oh, that's it. I'm going to do that. And then I kind of was like, oh, everyone I'm with, by the way, it takes like 5 years to get in the Sunday company or whatever it was for me then. all my peers were kind of making a living doing commercials. And I was like, oh, well, I think I can do those. So then I just got into acting to make money in commercials.
Yeah.
And then the more I was on that stage, I just loved it. I really, really loved it. And then I obviously did not get on Saturday Night Live, but I got on this show Punk'd.
Uh-huh.
After, you know, 9 years of auditioning and never, I booked two things in 9 years, a lawnmower commercial and a AM/PM gas station buyout. And I got unpunked. And then after like 9 years of convincing myself it would never happen, it just started happening very, very quickly.
Yeah. That you were really good on Punk'd though.
Thank you.
For within that role, like, because you did seem, it was very believable that you could be a guy, you know, like it's what for me is good acting is you don't have any sense that this is, it's the same thing as, you know, going like friends of mine that'll like go in and act like they have a French accent to a clerk just to make us laugh. And the clerk, if the clerk has no, and that for me, my theory of acting has always been it's lying. It's good lying. Not letting any, not giving any tell that you're not what you say you are.
Yeah.
And I've had people really offended by that. Like, no, it's about finding truth. Like, yeah, maybe, but that's not the first thing.
Sure.
The first thing is lying. Yeah. It's like,
I'm Gary Stomtrop.
Right.
No.
Like, yeah, I'm not a fucking helicopter pilot.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm wearing the headset and I seem like it, but I'm not really a helicopter pilot.
Yeah. Yeah. Like me as the audio engineer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
exactly.
All horseshit.
Yeah. But, so,
well, what's
Punk'd and then it just, you know.
Well, Punk'd came out and it was a very big show on MTV. I want to say it was the biggest show that year.
Yeah.
And, I immediately started getting meetings with like studio people, generals, and I went on one and they were casting this movie Without a Paddle. I think Punk'd came out maybe in February and maybe it stopped airing in April. And then in September, I was flying to New Zealand to be in Without a Paddle with Seth Green and Matthew Lillard and had never done any movie acting, done any screen acting really. And, landed with the perfect two guys because Seth had been doing it since he was six.
Yeah.
He'd been on Johnny Carson at nine years old or something.
I remember when he started to know him as Seth Green. It's like, I've seen that kid in a million commercials.
Oh, the most famously and my favorite thing is he was the cha-ching guy.
Oh, yeah.
Two burgers, free fries, and a drink. Cha-ching!
Yeah.
I'll send you down a YouTube wormhole where he got so famous from that they brought him to the New Orleans Saints game because they made that the team motto, cha-ching. And he had never seen the commercial because it only played like east of the Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And he goes down there at like 15 or 16 in a trench coat. He likes nunchucks.
Sure.
And he goes out on this football field, like 90,000 people are screaming cha-ching. And they made a little video about it for the local news. And it's all captured. I can't imagine a more surreal thing at 15 or 16. And he goes up in the middle of the field, does some karate and screams to ching and the place goes bananas. And we were doing Without a Paddle and somehow that came up and I was like, you were the cha-ching guy? I don't think I've ever been more blown away by finding out an actor had done something.
Yeah.
Mm. So anyways, I did that movie and then I was also doing, I would do King of the Hills, maybe done two or three. And then Mike Judge and I really hit it off during those sessions. And I think I went to lunch with him a couple times. And so when I got home, this script Idiocracy was floating around and I read it. And I said, I want to come in and read for Fredo. And he said, look, I like you, but I want him to be a big slob and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, can I just audition? I do this character. I used to do it at the Groundlings and I just feel like it would fit. So I came in and I did Fredo.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, well, that is funny. I think I see this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and then I got that. And then based on having worked with Mike Judge, Favreau was interested in me because he also loves Mike Judge as we all do. And then
Wait, can I stop you right there?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I read for that too.
Oh, you did?
I read for that too. And it was one of those ones where his reaction, because I read directly for him, and we'd known each other. I think he'd been on the Conan show, and we'd known each other. But, well, I did, because, I mean, I play a fucking idiot pretty well. I mean, like, Cabin Boy was the first thing anybody really knew me from. And that's like, I mean, almost, that's like IQ 10, you know. And so I just...
I'm wondering when we're going to enter into a phase where you really can't do that.
I don't know. But he was like, oh, yeah, this is, man, that was good. Yeah, I can see this.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Okay. All right. Well, man, that was really, no, that was really good. And, you know, and it's just like one of those ones where, you know, like, and a couple times you do it and you know, like, all right, fuck, I think I got this. Mm-hmm. And a couple times I got it. You know, mm-hmm. I find out later I got it. And that was one where I really was like, and then you fucking came along. Yeah,
did it make you angry at me? Because if I were you, I think I would have been like, wait, that guy? Why that guy?
No, it didn't make me angry at you. No, I mean, there's the envy. There's the envy and the lack of, and every time, and especially at that point, just wanting to be in any kind of movie. And also, that movie was so fucking funny and such a great, but, you know, but then it, like, also, too, it didn't.
Oh, yeah, it was 20 people saw it when it came out.
And then, but now it's like really, it's really.
And I had turned down.
A cultish kind of movie, and you were really, really good at it. If you had been shitty in it, I'd be mad at you.
Well, I mean? That happens to me all the time. Yeah, not all the time. It has happened to me where someone else gets cast, and I go, why the fuck did they hire? And then I see the movie, and I'm like, oh my God, they're so much better than I would have been.
Yeah.
I got to give it up.
Old school. They were really on me for Will Ferrell's part in Old School. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, and I don't remember something. I took another job or something. Yeah. I mean, but I can't say they offered it to me or anything. Right. But it was definitely, there was interest in me for that part. And then when I saw Will in it, I was like, oh, no. I am not Will Ferrell. I cannot be Will Ferrell.
No one is.
Yeah. No one is.
Well, interestingly enough, or I should say similarly, when I got Idiocracy, they were also wanting to meet with me for Wedding Crashers to play the role that ultimately Cooper played. And I was like, no, those two guys are the stars. And then you have the women and then there's no money. And then this thing is like, I have a much bigger part and there's more money. And I love Mike Judge and I just want to be associated with him, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was ultimately very... If you were just looking at career, that became the biggest R-rated movie of all time. And the other one didn't come out for 3 years. Yeah, and it came out on like 80 screens.
Yeah.
But then again, so that's a phase where I'm like, well, I shit the bed on that. You just, again, I wasn't offered it similar. They wanted to talk to
me.
But there was a couple years where I was like, well, I chose wrong. Because no one saw this thing I did. So it happened in a vacuum. And then now, 15 years later... That movie is very much like a cult movie that a lot of people have seen, and I'm delighted I was in it.
Absolutely.
So my perspective is just like a fucking merry-go-round.
Well, I
you know who was mad at me about it though? Because another person that read for Frito was Stern's old guy that he had the stand-up. He stabbed himself.
Oh, Artie Lang.
Artie Lang.
Ah.
Who I loved on the Stern Show. I thought he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I think he had read for it too. And then he kind of, had an axe to grind. I guess he has said many times on air, you know, I'm a whatever I am. But it's really fun. By the way, now that
Artie Lang fucked a woman who thought he was me.
Oh, really?
Ashamedly admitted it to me. And there's a part of me at the time, you know, I mean, I was like, well, somebody's getting laid being me, you know, not necessarily me. That's all right. Whatever. I guess I got that coin, to, you know, somewhere I can spend someday, you know.
That's a tricky moral one because it's like. If you want to fuck Andy Richter, you're also obligated to know who Andy Richter is on some level.
And there's also part of me, and nothing really against Artie, but like I find myself just aesthetically more appealing than Artie.
Sure.
But I know maybe he was thin at the time. You know, he goes up and down, whatever. But you know,
but I've now interviewed enough people that I've had several people sit down and go like, oh, well, I was offered Zathura before you. And I'm like,
really?
I didn't know that. That's interesting. I thought I was his first pick. I thought it was the first phone call he made. So I've had a bunch of those already.
The weirdest one for me is Modern Family.
Mm.
When the casting first went around for that, the pictures for the Eric Stone Street and Jesse Tyler Ferguson characters were me and Tony Hale.
Ah.
And at the time.
That would have been great.
At the time I knew I was going to be going back to work with Conan on The Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a secret.
Uh-huh.
And so they offered me that role.
Oh.
And I was like, I don't know, a sitcom, and I, you know, and I had qualms about it. Yeah. Like, and honestly,
we would be doing this interview on a hot air balloon had you taken that role.
No shit.
On your goal. Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't be doing a fucking podcast if I'd gotten that. I'd own a podcast network like Scott Aukerman. No, but I one thing I will say, and I will say this, and I mean, that show, they hired some fantastic fucking joke writers, and that cast is a top-notch cast. But the first, in the pilot script, the first joke was like, you know, the Julie Bowen and the Ty Burrell character. I don't, you know, I don't know their name. I do that with like Game of Thrones. Right, you know, right, I just call everybody by their names, you know.
Yeah.
But she says something to him that's like, where he's like, I'm wearing workout clothes because I work out. And she goes, no, you don't. And he looked at the camera. And up to that point, we had no indication that this was a documentary show.
Right.
And the office, and I was like, they're just going to use the offices documentary style with no explanation. And then a few pages later, I see a confessional straight on interview. There's no fucking documentarians.
Right.
Like, you're just going to, you're going to lift that.
Yep.
You're going to lift the entire, like the skeleton of this dinosaur that is a brontosaurus. And you're going to say, well, it's not a brontosaurus. Like, it was such, so offensive to me just in terms of like, well, which is like, hooray for me that I'm concerned about originality. But I was just like, no.
I'm going to give you an AA saying, which is, you can't be too dumb for AA, but you can be too smart. And I would say that was a case where you can be too smart for your own good. Like, who gives a flying fuck what format it is?
But honestly,
but I've been hung up about the same
but
shit.
But honestly, and I mean, and if I had that choice to do 10 times, I would have chosen to go back to work with Conan on, because I was so excited about going back to making immediate TV.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I that mean, is, I've only experienced it really on the podcast where like, yeah, you do it and then it's on.
Yeah.
And
nobody gets to say anything. They just, you don't have to wait for somebody to come back from fucking, you know, Maui.
Right.
Wait,
the train's moving too fast.
Yeah, to have them not understand your point. Mm-hmm. And then you have to make them believe that you adjusted your point for them when you really didn't. I mean, the art of taking notes from Hollywood dum-dums is to make them feel answered when in fact you've really not answered them at all, you know, not changed.
Well, I would
anything.
Argue that's even one of the best skills
of life.
Probably life.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly like filmmakers, TV show makers is learning how to make people feel heard.
Yeah.
Giving them something.
Yep.
And then still figuring out how to
still
do what
doing
you
want
to do.
Yeah. It's the most interesting too, because if you just do stuff for yourself, stay home. And if you just do stuff for other people, ugh, gross. So you got to, you know, there's a balance. That tension between the balance is really important.
And I have to just acknowledge a mentor of mine, which is Favreau, where he's one of the, I have a very hard time asking for help. Mm-hmm. I'd rather die if I was drowning.
Yeah.
But I have on occasion asked him for advice because he's clearly a phenomenal director.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of his tips to me have just been the judo of that. He is just a master at judo, redirecting that note into something that could help service.
Sure, you know,
like he really knows how to get the thing he wants to make made. And everyone feeling good about it.
That's
and
good.
That's quite an asset.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and then from there, I mean, you know, we're running out of time.
Yeah,
so,
it happens.
You know, people can look at your IMDb page if they want to know where that happened.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk to you about your wife, and because you guys have such a lovely relationship that I know from firsthand and from firsthand exposure. And also, you guys kind of have, and this is actually something that I wanted to talk to you about, because I do you ever worry, because you also kind of have a public version of your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
That scares me.
Yeah. Oh, it scares me. I talk about it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I very much acknowledge the pitfalls of that.
Yeah. Because you guys do commercials together.
We do commercials together. In the commercials, we have a perfect life.
We're
decide not to go to the Oscars to watch TV on the couch.
Yeah.
Mind you, these are all, I wrote those. So, it was shit we do. Like, we bail on stuff.
Yeah. But also to you're not just getting a check and doing what you're told.
Right.
You have some agency in it.
Yes, at least together. Now, I sell things all over town.
And yeah, oh, I don't, yeah, me too. It's yeah, like, am I to not sell things? That's the way it works.
And when I do it personally, I don't have as many kind of restrictions or concerns.
Or qualms,
but,
yeah.
But when we work together, I feel very controlling over that. And yeah. In fact, when we met with Samsung, we had been offered a bunch of different things to do together, and we had never done them. And then when we met with them, I said, look, I'm happy to play who we are. I'm yeah. not happy to snap on some kind of archetype of husband, wife, and I'm a bozo, and I think she's naggy, like yeah, whatever. I'm yeah. like, we will be us, and if that appeals to you, then let's party. And they yeah. said, totally, and that's great. And we did it. But my fear has always been people will hashtag us like couples goals.
Yeah.
That's like a big hashtag for us. If we post something together or whatever, yeah. it's, oh, couples goals. And, my fear is that people will think we saw each other across the room at a party and we were each other's missing pieces. Mm-hmm. And that that people who might look up to us need only find their Kristen Bell or their Dax Shepard. Yeah. And I just try at all opportunities to say, like, no, we started in couples therapy. We were a match made in hell. We're opposites. I don't value anything she values and vice versa. I at the core was like, this person has one of the best personalities I've ever been around. I want to be in a porch with this person when I'm old. This person would be an amazing parent if I had children. And I think at her core, she's a very good person that
she's
I can trust.
She's a relentlessly positive
she is.
Person.
It fucking annoys me because it's effortless. Like yeah. I go to meetings and I journal and I do all this shit to act half as good as she does just innately.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so I just try to be, I guess the way I try to counteract the fairy tale of it is just to go like, no, we fight all the time. Well, even when she was on my podcast, it was probably miserable for the listeners. The first 45 minutes were bickering. She don't want to be there. She wants yeah. to be at Michael's buying fabric. And she thinks I'm trying to con her into saying something that she would never say. You know, yeah, the yeah. whole thing was a shit show for the first half. But
the
then we found
thing
our way
to me
back.
Was how patient she was. And you, I mean, you admitted this later, like how much you talk over her, how much you try and tell her, no, that's not what you meant. What you meant was, and I was just like, what the fuck are you doing? If I were her, I'd be like, no, I meant what I meant. She's so calm and patient and loving and is so like thinking about you being nervous in this yes. new situation uh-huh. and has taken care of you. And it was like,
well, it is 80% her. And then it is also, I have built up goodwill over 12 years, which is, I do admit when I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I do go
she
away.
Knows, and it's obvious that, yeah.
Yeah, I listened to that then, and I was more mortified than anyone else could be. I'm like, I am so controlling.
Yeah, right.
Oh.
But what ended up is like you could, what I took out of that one was just how much she loves you.
Yes.
And I mean, yeah. and obviously you love her, but it was kind of lovely. I mean, I did feel like, and you've learned, we were hearing you learn yeah, how yeah, to do yeah. this.
Oh,
you
that's
know?
Happened
and,
a bunch of times.
And learning
already.
It, yeah, but learning it directly from her. So.
Well, the other thing, there is two layers though. There's our life with our kids and, you know, that's not always sunshine. Mm-mm. She was really depressed the last 2 weeks. She said publicly on Instagram, she said that, so I'm not telling anything out of school. And then for me, that's hard. I'm an approval junkie. And if she's short with me and everything, I start getting like, well, I deserve to be in a kitchen in the morning with someone who fucking appreciates me. And I start getting resentful that, you know, and then I stop and I go, oh my God, she's in pain. She needs my help. And I got to stop thinking about how it's affecting me.
Yeah.
This whole thing happens, right? But I will say when we have to work together, that is the sweetest spot for us because we have a shared goal, which yeah. is be good in this interview, be good on this talk show, be good in this thing we're filming.
Yeah.
And when we work together, it is the easiest time we have as a couple.
That's
nice. We have this great.
That's nice. It's the family business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have she's my favorite scene partner in the world.
That's
and I am her favorite scene partner. Yeah. And we just, there's never any issue of figuring out who's going to talk now or who takes this thing or, and that's, so when we get to work together, we actually will some of the highlights of us as a couple, we drive home holding hands and going like, oh, we do that good together. I like having you as a partner.
That's really great. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah
it's hard for some people to,
I was just, cause when you said people would put hashtag couples goals sometimes about me and my wife, and I'm going through a divorce right now. And that mm-hmm. was always, It's hard, you know.
I feel that too.
I do like that people, and I mean, and there was, and there was, and still is, like some really wonderful components of our relationship, and for many different reasons, it stopped working.
And it bore two beautiful humans.
Yeah, and I mean, it made two great kids, and we were married for 25 years, and we are very much a success.
Yeah,
I can do believe we are very much a success.
I agree.
But you know, in the last few years, there were times when people would think, and I mean, people would say it, and people would say about it, like friends of ours would say, like, you guys have such, because we were friends and we were funny together, and we were friends together. We didn't like have ads that we did together, but it is kind of, you do feel this public version of your relationship that people love, and you know, well, and it's great to have people love it and be admire it and and feel it as something aspirational, but then you sit there and be like, oh my God, I don't know if I can live up to that.
Well,
you know,
here's my, like, the direct comparison to me is sobriety. So like everyone knows in sobriety, you only have today. You're sober today. There is a good, by the way, this is why people aren't supposed to say they're an AA, and I acknowledge it. I do it because I think I'm willing to have some people mad at me for however many dudes might look up to me and have seen this thing work.
Yep.
So I'm willing to anger some people. But the reason is very good at its core, which is if I'm out here saying I'm an AA and then I publicly go relapse, which is very likely. Yeah. Most people relapse.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden AA doesn't work because I fucked up. So I get that. But in the same way, I never think, oh, I'm going to be sober for the rest of my life. I have to, it has to be just today because I know everyone can lose their sobriety. I similarly look at marriage that way. Like, yes, things are great today. I might be couples goals today, but I also might fuck up big time in 2 months. Yeah, I'm aware of that.
She might.
Yes.
Yeah. Or you might together. You might out of neglect or whatever, you know?
Yes. And so, yeah, life can get too big. There's a million different things. Yeah. And so I'm always, a little hesitant because I'm like, this thing's just like sobriety. It'll work as long as we work our ass off at it. And we might lose the appetite to work our ass off at it. We're humans and, you know.
I actually think that attitude of AA about like, I can't say I'm in AA. I mean, I understand the anonymous part of it and all the reasons for that. But to not say I saw Dax in an AA meeting.
Although you can, because I'm open about it.
I know, but you know what I mean. Yes. But anybody that you see at an AA meeting.
Yeah.
But to say you shouldn't talk about being an AA because of your eventual possibility of failure is a fear-based way of thinking, and it's not a healthy way of thinking.
Yeah.
And that it's basically the argument to end any kind of acknowledgement of a self-betterment process.
Yes.
You know, like to talk about I'm in therapy. Like if I, you know—
Well, therapy must not work because you got divorced.
Yeah, yeah. Or you know, or if like I become a fucking mess down the road or my brain chemistry goes haywire to be like, well, I'll fuck you and your therapy. It didn't work. It didn't, you know, it didn't keep you from, you know, rehab or whatever, you know. Yeah.
I would hope people only hear from me that AA got me these 15 years.
Yeah.
And if I go out, it won't be a failing of
from
that.
From just this conversation, what you talked about, what sobriety has done for you is absolutely like a brochure for sobriety. And the fact that the method that you used it got you there from, you know, and opened your mind and your heart to your own self-acceptance and your own process of learning. Then, yeah, that's some pretty fucking good advertising. And anybody that's angry about it is looking at a deficit kind of life as opposed to a surplus kind of life.
Well, and it's basically the thing that I've never loved about religion, which is we do have a text in AA. And in AA, it says members of AA shall remain anonymous at the level of press and television. So I am breaking one of the covenants.
Yeah.
But I also think that book was written 80 years ago when it meant something much different to say you're an alcoholic in public.
Sure, sure.
The social pariahness of having that problem then was so different than it is now that to me it's falling into the category of people hanging onto that Bible, this thing that was written 2,000 years ago, and there's no way it can evolve and keep up and change and grow, or that our Constitution shouldn't continue to keep up and grow.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a frustration I have with just people's kind of innate desire to hold on to some tradition and just never question it.
Yes,
so you know, I've never liked that about any other thing. I don't know why I would like it about AA.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, we got to.
Should we take our pants off?
No, no. I mean, yes, but wait till everyone goes.
I want to hashtag couple goals with you and I.
Well, this is the way. I mean, I feel like you kind of, you know, we've talked a lot about what you've learned. I mean, that's the third of the questions. And where you're going, I don't know. Where are you going? You've directed a movie. You know, you've got the podcast.
Yeah.
You're working on another show. You got a regular show now, right? Don't
I'm on a show called ABC. I'm on a show called Bless This Mess on ABC.
Oh, right, with Lake Bell.
I have a game show called Spin the Wheel on
Fox.
That's
right. Game show, motherfucker. That's my deal. I'm the game show host.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
And then I have the podcast, yeah. And this will sound corny, and I recognize it's an enormous privilege to be able to have this point of view, but I don't give a fuck where I'm going. I used to care so much.
Yeah.
And when I got the things I thought were bringing me closer to that, they never were what I wanted them to be. And then the things I didn't want to do turned out to be the best things in my life. You know, I didn't want to go on television and be on Parenthood. I thought I'd never get to do movies again. That turned out to be the very best work experience of my life. Probably redefined me as an actor, these things. So what I have learned is I am very bad at picking what's best for me. When I get what's best for me, I'm rarely happy.
Absolutely.
So
I strove to be number one on the call sheet, the star of a television show, and I did it three times, which I'm fucking thrilled and will feel to the end of my days like, God damn, I was a star of three different television shows.
Yeah.
But I thought that would be it. And then it kind of, none of them really worked out in any sort of long-term kind of way. In respect, they did, like in terms of the respect that is given to them. But they didn't last in like that. I don't have that yacht. I don't have that beach house, that castle in Normandy. But honestly, it's like, And I also kind of feel like, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be number one on the call sheet. I tried that. And maybe that's not. And I don't. And honestly, there's a lot of fucking pressure with that.
Oh, God. Yeah.
So much of the shit that Conan has to do. I'm just glad. Like, oh, my God, there's so many meetings and boring nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
And they leave me alone.
Because I had only exclusively directed for a couple years. And then I went back to just acting. And I got on that set. I was like, oh, God. I get to walk out of here after cut. And I don't have to worry about a fucking thing.
Yeah.
What scenes they get today, where the sun's at in the sky, not my problem.
Just get makeup and come say your words and go sit in your little air-conditioned box.
Yeah. You
know, that's great.
Well, more and more, I think the thing that I make myself run through the formula is just, okay, I'm on my deathbed. Is someone going to come in and bring me a printout of my box office and my television ratings?
Yes.
And is that what I'm going to stare at and feel accomplished?
Yeah.
Or am I going to think about the fun I had on the set, the experience of it? And I just, you know, I'm increasingly trying to make decisions that will result in fun memories and not worry about where it's going to end up.
And also, when you have kids, everything else is fucking nonsense.
They're the total just key to
ridiculous.
That.
Ridiculous.
Yep.
The things that you used to worry about it that you know, they're just nonsense.
Yep.
They make everything seem stupid comparison.
I got fired from a guest star role on a sitcom a year and a half ago or 2 years ago for something they really begged me to come in and do, and I didn't have time, and I made the time, and then I did the table read, and then they fired me later that afternoon. And on the ride home, when I got the call, I was like, God, what does this say about me? Well, is this something that'll get out in the town, blah, blah, blah. And I was really caring a lot about it. And then I walked in the house, and the two girls were sitting there, and I was like, they don't even understand what I do. Mm-mm. That's not what they've liked about me, that I go to some studio to make jokes.
No.
And nothing has changed, you know?
The
things I now value are kind of in impermeable? No, that's not the word. You know, they just... They can't really be
immovable. Maybe.
They can't. The thing I now like most about myself really can't be decided by an outside party.
Yeah.
Whether or not I'm doing a good job as a dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love you.
I love you.
And thank you so much for coming and doing this.
This was lovely.
I mean,
I hope you're number one for many, many weeks.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I hope I can come do a live one for you. You asked me to do a live one for you and I wasn't able to schedule wise, but that would be really fun.
They're incredibly fun. And again, to have people already love the thing you do and to have that kind of pressure taken away, it's like, I'll start getting freaked out about a live show. Oh, I hope it's amazing. And I'm like, no, it's going to be the exact thing they want. That's why they bought tickets to it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to go there and do stand up for 70 minutes. Yep.
They know the product.
Yes. Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
Most of your career, you're not selecting for who likes you. You're just stepping out on a stage and you got to win everyone over.
Yeah, no.
It's much nicer this way.
Absolutely.
All right.
Well, thank you for coming. And thank you out there at your desks, in your cars.
On your treadmills.
Yeah, on your treadmills, hiding under a table. I don't know what your deal is.
Horseback.
I'm horseback. Let the horse listen. Put one earbud in the horse. Let the horse have some fun. But thank you for listening, and we will see you next time on The Three Questions. Bye-bye.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.